current state on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. Among the great MSU basketball moments yesterday, the frosting on the cake for me after a great game was when all the CBS basketball commentators picked MSU to prevail in the tournament and make it to the Final Four. And they were unanimous. There was not one dissenting vote amongst the three or four of them. That, after such a pasting of Michigan, was special. Coming up later on the program here today, we will talk about the modernization of the Lansing School District with School Board President Peter Spadafore. Zombies in higher education. Now that's interesting. And we're also going to talk about flood preparation here in mid-Michigan. There's a lot of snow that remains to melt here in our area, and we were face-to-face with it much of the weekend here, as it turns out. We're going to talk about flood preparation with Captain Chris Kolensky of the Michigan State Police. That is his charge. This is also a big day at Michigan State for another important reason. A host of dignitaries are formally breaking ground at the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams, commonly known as FRIB. FRIB represents cutting-edge research in nuclear science, and current state's Kevin Lavery has reported on FRIB many times over the years. He joins me now. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Real good.
Great. FRIB is a particle accelerator that will smash elements together at light speed to uncover isotopes, which will tell scientists more about what our universe is made of. I'm thinking back to seventh grade science here. It's projected that FRIB will generate about $1 billion worth of economic activity and draw talent from all over the world. I took a tour of the site recently with project director Dr. Thomas Glossmacher, and he told me that this groundbreaking means a lot more than just shovels and dirt.
Well, it's a great day for MSU, for FRIB, and the country. Rare isotope science is one of the things where MSU was the leader for many years. The Japanese and the Germans have overtaken us, but by building FRIB, we'll be the leader again. And we're at the construction site here, and this is where the excavation will be. The LINAC will be three stories down, and then we have four stories of buildings on top.
We're building this as a groundbreaking. I'm assuming you'll have the ceremonial silver shovels in the ground?
Well, we actually have fake golden shovels, one notch up from silver shovels.
There you go, there you go. But what does it really mean, though, to have a groundbreaking? Because in reality, the ground has been broken. The ground has been penetrated for at least 2 years. There's a lot of infrastructure beneath our feet right now.
Yeah, the groundbreaking is really the symbol that FRIB will really happen. It's the public acknowledgement that everybody in the government, DOE, MSU, the state of Michigan, is aligned and that we're ready as a team to deliver. And with the groundbreaking, we will start the civil construction. The site preparation is what you're referring to, has already been done. We have earth retention systems in. We have relocated some utilities. But the groundbreaking really symbolizes that from now on, we will deliver FRIB and we'll have it done in hopefully 2020, officially in 2022.
So really, this is the point of no return that everyone has been working for very diligently.
That's right. This is the point of no return, and the public acknowledgement and the symbol of the civil construction going on. In FRIB, the civil construction is actually only about 30% of the total construction, because we need to build the accelerator in parallel. And when FRIB is done in 2017, we then need 2 years to install the accelerator, an additional year to commission it and make it work. And that's why it's going to take till 2020, even though the building will be done in 2017.
We still have some construction workers right here as we speak. Can you tell me a bit about what they're doing, even very generally?
Those construction workers are removing frost and snow in preparation of the groundbreaking, and then starting later this week, the official construction will start. They'll have to excavate, and then they need to put a mud mat in, and then they need to put in steel and build the wall for the tunnel, which is 45,000 square feet, three stories underground. Then we build shafts up to grade, and we fill back with fill, and then we build the surface building four stories tall.
It's amazing that size infrastructure is below us right now, and I think someone once explained to me that it's the dimensions of, I think it's 100 by 600 feet, something of that effect?
It's roughly right. It's 70 feet wide and 550 feet long, so it's about two football fields long, and that'll be underground.
And again, the whole point of FRIB is particle acceleration, laser-guided beams of light that smash through matter that create, even for the tiniest fraction of a second, isotopes that don't normally exist through normal means. And those isotope signatures reveal to us what?
Those isotopes will be used by scientists to make discoveries about what holds us together. What's the nature of the nuclear force that holds us together? How are the elements made? Why is there more matter than antimatter in the universe? But there are also applications. Those isotopes will be made available to scientists who can use them for rare studies, material science, medical applications, biological applications. And so there's a whole host of applications, and folks will come to MSU to do those kinds of experiments.
What do you hope will be that exciting breakthrough that EFRIB will deliver?
So one of the things people think we'll find out is that we will understand how the elements heavier than iron are made. We don't know right now. We have some theories, but EFRIB will provide the isotopes to test those and to become predictive.
So to recap, today's significance of the groundbreaking is a symbol that the Department of Energy, Michigan State University, all of our congressional delegation are of one mind that this project will be secure in its funding and its execution.
That's right. Congress appropriates funding every year. But now that we have broken ground, we are in agreement that we will deliver EFRIB, and our team is ready. And for the next 6 years, we will work very hard on this and will succeed.
Dr. Thomas Glassmacher is the director of EFRIB, the Facility for Rare Isotope Beams. This is a day many people in this community, this state, and even this country have waited for a long time. Congratulations.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Kevin Lavery.
That's the sound of cars rushing through piles of melting snow here in mid-Michigan. The mercury is slowly climbing. Thursday marks the first day of spring, and as the snow fades away, it's time to be aware of the dangers of flooding. High water can be a dangerous scenario for drivers on the roads and also for anyone in low-lying areas. First responders are getting ready for those potential hazards, and joining me to talk about that is Captain Chris Kolensky. Chris is the Deputy State Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security with the Michigan State Police. Chris Kolensky, welcome to Current State.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. We've seen a lot of snowfall this winter, as everyone is perfectly aware. Are emergency planners particularly worried about wide-scale flooding this spring?
They are. They're always worried about flooding, especially if they've had it happen in the past. But this year especially, Michigan might see some widespread flooding in the next couple of months. And the typical flood risk in Michigan this time of year is 5 to 20%, and currently it's at 40 to 90%. So it's a concern.
That is, and is that attributable simply to the amount of snow we received?
It's a combination of the snowpack that we have. So yes, the amount of snow we've received, as well as how long it's staying here. So the longer it stays, the chances of a rapid melt is significantly going to affect our flooding.
Mm-hmm. So far, everyone is talking about how cold it has stayed, how frequently it's been cold on one account, and obviously we're just a few days from spring and we're still seeing overnight low temperatures in the single digits. That must improve the outlook as far as you're concerned, or not?
It does. I want warm weather here just as much as anybody else. I am kind of tired of the cold weather. However, we need to stay below 50 degrees during the daytime, and we need to have the freezing temperatures at night. So we have that slow, gradual melt. Mm-hmm. So the cold weather at night, that's a good thing for us as far as flooding. We don't want to see significant amounts of rain. If we can have small rains with breaks in between, that's definitely going to help us out.
In the spring, we often see flood advisories or warnings, whether it's on TV or radio or even on alerts on mobile devices. Do you get the sense that the public at large applies the appropriate level of caution to the possibility of flooding?
I don't think it's where we need to be. I think we can always do better. Lately, we have had a lot more weather-related issues in this state. It's becoming more and more frequent. So I think people are becoming more in tune to preparing for these types of events, but we're not quite where we need to be. Mm-hmm. But we've gotten better. And the local emergency managers really do a great job informing the public. And if they've had flooding, like along the Grand River or in Ionia, people in those areas, you know, they absolutely are more prepared than others may be.
Talk to us about the plans that first responders have to protect people and property, especially in those low-lying areas near rivers and lakes.
Well, all emergencies and disasters start and end at the local level. And we work with our local emergency management partners. The state police has what we call district coordinators throughout the state of Michigan. They're kind of our liaison with the local emergency management programs. And we are in constant dialogue with our local emergency managers. So we'll push programs and different things down to our local emergency management programs, and they're the ones who really are engaged at the local level, making sure that their communities have the plans in place, that the threats and the hazards and all the risks are identified, and that they prepare appropriately for those threats and hazards and risks.
Are the people who live in floodplains always aware that they're living in a floodplain?
Some of the more obvious ones, I mean, right on the river, but sometimes people don't realize that they are in floodplains, and they definitely should check that, because if they are living in a floodplain, they should have some additional insurance, because insurance doesn't always cover flooding. So they're going to need some additional coverage, and we've been kind of pushing that message out when we knew that we were going to have some additional flooding this year to get with your insurance company, because it may take up to 30 days for some of those policies to take effect.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, we had a segment on the program involving, I mean, this is a separate story, really, but the whole flood insurance landscape is very confused right now, and it's really a national story. Certainly in the Lansing area, the Grand River and the Red Cedar are the most watched places for flooding, but often those rivers crest over a period of days, so there's sometimes some advance warning. Are there areas that are especially prone to flash flooding in our area?
The rivers, it's a very difficult thing to predict. We work very close with the National Weather Service. So like last spring, we have the National Weather Service in our State Emergency Operations Center. And we kind of are, all the state agencies will be housed up in that center, helping the locals with any of the needs that they have if they have a disaster or an incident. Last spring, we could predict by watching the river gauges when Grand Rapids was going to flood. Mm-hmm. So we could predict when it was going to crest.
Okay.
But there wasn't any ice. We didn't have the deep frost. So now the issue is our gauges may show, or the National Weather Service gauges may show a lower risk of flooding. And then as soon as we get a rapid melt or ice jams, you know, the ice will start to break up, and if they start jamming up, that's when we could have some serious issues. It could change quickly mm-hmm. because of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next 5 days out, I want to say here in Lansing, we are expecting temperatures above the 40 mark, I want to say twice, like Wednesday and Thursday, or maybe tomorrow and Wednesday, one or the other. Is that I take it that's a pretty good scenario for this time of year?
Yes, at this time of year, we would rather take those couple of days, and again, that colder temperatures in the evening. The last thing we want is 5 days of, you know, 55, 60-degree weather. That's going to cause us some concerns.
I couldn't help but notice somewhere, somebody on Twitter today mentioned that 2 years ago today, it was 78 degrees. So that's the kind of scenario you're hoping to avoid, I take it.
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct.
Break down for us, what is a good home preparation plan for before to address a flood?
Well, a lot of people may seem like it's a big job preparing for flooding because they just don't know where to begin. And first and foremost, every household should have an emergency preparedness kit. And by taking the initiative to build an emergency preparedness kit, people are going to be very, better prepared in case an emergency or a disaster happens. And that means having things like water, at least 3 gallons of water per person. We're looking for a 72-hour time frame of people being self-sufficient because responders may not be able to get to them. One, because of, you know, they just physically cannot get to that location.
Right.
Or two, it's everyone's so busy, they just can't get to them at that time. Additionally, food, 3-day supply of non-perishable food per person, some medications, a battery-powered or hand-crank radio, flashlights with extra batteries, and a first aid kit, and pet supplies. A lot of times people forget that, you know, they need to have supplies for their pets also. And we also want them to have a complete change of clothing and footwear, especially with floods. We don't want people walking in flood water. We see on television all the time people walking through flood water.
Yeah.
That is not a good thing. There's a lot of disease, a lot of issues in that water.
Let's talk about that, though. I mean, health concerns after a flood, the waters are at greater risk of not being sanitary. What should people do about drinking and bathing water?
When a flood occurs, that's when we work with our health department partners. And we have, like the Department of Natural Resources assists with making sure people's wells get rechecked. They got to check the water again. There's just a lot of steps that have to go into place after a flood, but to listen to the local emergency managers. They will provide the direction of whether or not the water is safe to drink, or we have a boiled water advisory. So they really need to stay in tune with their local emergency management programs, but by having their own supplies with them, they should be okay. Again, 3-day supply.
72 hours is the real key threshold.
That's absolutely correct.
Is that it? What about drivers encountering standing water on roads? I mean, I do hear about precautions about that, but do people heed those precautions generally?
Generally, but some people feel that they can just drive right through it. And the problem with that, if it's moving water, just a few inches of water can move a vehicle. It definitely can sweep you off your feet if the water's going over the road. A bigger concern is while it may look stable underneath that roadway, it could be washed out. And the only thing that's standing is that asphalt or concrete. And the weight of a vehicle could drop that vehicle right through. The vehicle could go right through it.
Mm-hmm.
So the structure underneath the road might not be stable, and more than likely is not stable.
Mm-hmm. How far into the future, then, as we sit here today on St. Patrick's Day, Monday the 17th, how far into the future are you looking at the weather forecast?
We have webinars with the National Weather Service. We have one actually this morning, and they provide us 2-week outlooks. Now, obviously, we're looking at the weather every single day, but they can project within 2 weeks kind of what we're going to see and what the trends are going to be. And we'll continue to do that until the threat of flooding subsides or it comes and we have to open the State Emergency Operations Center.
What's it like working in emergency management and Homeland Security? your title is Deputy State Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security.
It is. It's extremely busy. It's an extremely busy job. And it just never ends. There's always something there, whether it's on the Homeland Security side or the emergency management side. We've been fortunate in Michigan. We're surrounded by the Great Lakes, which somewhat insulates us from a lot of weather issues like some of our other states see every year. They have catastrophic events. But the weather's changing, and we're going to see some more catastrophic events, or at least more flooding or severe storms in the future because of it. And that's going to keep me busy, and my staff. I have great staff.
You're based here in Lansing, then?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Well, it's been great talking to you about this. It's a pretty relevant topic. Captain Chris Kolansky is Deputy State Director of Emergency Management and Homeland Security with the Michigan State Police. Thank you, Captain Kolansky.
Thank you.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Art, like life, goes through phases and changes. a longtime mid-Michigan artist who relocated to New Mexico a few years ago, is exploring the inspirations there and has just come out with her first film. Current State's Melissa Benmark caught up with Jane Rosemont at her new home in Santa Fe, New Mexico, to talk about The Pie Lady of Pie Town. Hi, Melissa.
Hey, Mark. A lot of folks are going to be familiar with Jane and Dick Rosemont. He was one of the forces behind Flat Black and Circular, the East Lansing record shop. She did fine arts, photography, and other arts here in the East Lansing area for a number of years, and they became moved to New Mexico. They had a rental house out there, and then they started spending more time there, and the next thing, they just had to go. And so I caught up with Jane Rosemont at her new home in Santa Fe last week to ask about The Pie Lady of Pie Town. We began talking about Jane's progression from still photography to filmmaking.
A long time ago, I took a class, a photography class, with Jim Colando, who is an East Lansing person. And that just changed my life. It was I fell in love with film. I fell in love with shooting. I fell in love with developing the film. I fell in love with processing the prints. I fell in love with the smell of the chemicals.
Oh, I love the smell of darkroom chemicals. That was my father, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it really, you know, and I did that for a long time. And then one time I was working in the darkroom at home, and I got really sick. I mean, sick to the point where I had to stop and run up and go to bed and lay still, like I was poisoned or something. But I didn't put two and two together until that happened, you know, three or four other times. So what had happened is that eventually the chemicals started to poison me, you know, through absorption through all those years.
Wow.
And it's true, I didn't wear gloves because, you know, we like those stained fingers.
So, right, right.
And I had to stop, and it broke my heart. And, of course, one option was for me to go ahead and shoot and farm out the film, you know, to a processing place. And at that time, there were plenty. But I couldn't do that. It hurt me that I couldn't do that. So I pretended I lost interest. And instead, I started to paint and work in other art mediums. But I always missed it. So in digital photography, first came on the scene, it was pretty pathetic in terms of quality. You know, at the beginning, it just wasn't, the quality wasn't there. But digital photography very quickly caught up with the demands of pros. And once it got to that point, I dove back in. And I love still photography. I miss it. Since working on the film, I have not really, except for a shot here and there, I haven't been able to immerse myself in shooting, and I do miss it.
So how did you get from still photography to making a film documentary?
Well, as a fine art photographer, I guess, and the fact that I love film. You know, Dick and I were on the film selection committee for the East Lansing Film Festival. We loved film. So I always thought at some point I would make a film. But I imagine it would be really arty and abstract, like my photography. But, you know, you never know what gets thrown in your path. And this little story came up, and there was never a question. I just knew I had to do this story.
So without giving too much away for our listeners, what is the story of the Pie Lady of Pie Town?
Okay, well, let's see. The short version is it's a story of how a successful Dallas businesswoman, she was in the music industry and advertising industry, chose to bake pie in a remote, dusty town in the middle of nowhere. And I mean in the middle of nowhere. There's no gas station, there's no motel, there's no grocery store, there's no resources to speak of.
People don't even, when I've said Pie Town, New Mexico, they think I've made that up.
Well, I have a story about that as well. But, you know, Dick and I had this rental home here in Santa Fe, so we would take road trips when we would come out. So we took a road trip. We drove south. We drove through some ghost towns, which New Mexico has plenty of. And we ended up at this really spectacular place, again, in the middle of nowhere, the San Agustin Plains, called the Very Large Array. Now, I know that sounds really unscientific, but it's a highly scientific place and an important place in the field of astronomy. It's 27 huge radio telescopes in various configurations that study deep space.
Isn't that the one that was in Contact?
Exactly. Jodie Foster made it in Contact. So when these radio telescopes are spread out as far as they can go, it's the size of Washington, D.C. They're really kind of more dramatic when they're squished together. But remember, this is the plains. So this is where the deer and the antelope play, Melissa. This is really, really far out there, and we're just in awe. We saw animals we'd never seen before, and you can walk up to one of these telescopes. And I was pretty excited, so I went in the gift shop to see if there's any books, because I never could have enough books. And I saw a mileage chart for different cities, and it said Pi Town, 45 miles. Of course, I thought it was a joke, like many people do.
Right.
And so I'm laughing, and I went up to the woman. I said, "So what's in Pi Town?" And she kind of leaned over, and she looked me square in the eye, and she said, "Pie." So how could we not go there, right? We drove to Pie Town, and really, I was shocked, because there is nothing there except two pie shops. And Dick, bless his heart, who obviously wasn't thinking very clearly, said, "Well, which one should we go to?" And I said, "You goofball, you go to both."
Well, you got to get the full experience, right?
Yeah, right. So we did. We went to both. So Kathy is the pie lady. So her pie shop is called the Pioneer Pie Shop. And we sat next to the shelf of pies, because Dick gets nervous if he can't reach the food. So, anyway, we overheard Kathy talking to customers about how ASCAP and BMI were harassing them about the music that they played on Friday nights.
Even in Pie Town.
In Pie Town. I mean, really, in the middle of nowhere, these locals who choose to live on the edge of the grid, who just want to play music, are getting harassed. So obviously, since we've been involved in the music industry, we talked a lot about the music industry, and we signed her book and promised to come back. And 6 years later, we did.
So how did you jump from having a little double dose of dessert to to making a movie?
Well, that didn't happen actually until 2012. And we went back with our friend Dewey Lawrence, who is also from East Lansing. And we spent hours there, and we were just having so much fun. Kathy just, she is so enthusiastic about pie and about people, and for her, pie is love, and for her, pie is peace. And I sat there, and I said to Dewey, I said, this is a movie. He goes, yes, yes. And so he is getting credit in the film as being the instigator, because he really goaded me to do this film. And at the time, I was thinking it would be a very short film, maybe 10 minutes. The film is now a half hour. I could probably easily go back and do a full-length film in general. But it's about her place in history there. So the name Pie Town comes from the 1920s, when some rancher was selling gasoline to other ranchers and decided to make pie to help sustain them. And back then, pie wasn't delicious as we know it. It was dried bean pie or dried apple pie.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to give this away, because it's in the film, how it came to be called Pie Town officially. So what I like about the film is it does talk about Kathy and how she got there, but it also includes the history of Pie Town and how it came to be. And I was really fortunate to get the actor Wes Studi to narrate the history parts. And Wes is from Avatar and Dances with Wolves and Last of the Mohicans, and that was great to have him help out. He makes pies too, so he was interested.
So I have to ask you, is there an official fruit pie of New Mexico? Because I'm thinking, if it's that remote out there, that certain things are just going to be hard. Like, strawberries, I would think, are going to be kind of hard to get out there and keep good.
Right. I would say, in New Mexico, New Mexico has a state question, and it's red or green. And
that,
of course, is referring to chiles. So I would say that unofficially, the New Mexico state pie would be apple pie with chile.
Red or green?
I think green, actually, for the pies.
Well, you know.
And it's really good because it's subtle. You don't bite into it, and it's not, you know, you don't pucker up your mouth in disgust. It's really very subtle and good. And I believe that originated in Pie Town, I think, by the other pie shop there called the Good Pie.
So that's for the next movie, right?
I'm serious. I could do a full-length story about Pie Town. It was really fun to dig in and find out all these wonderful historical things. I have a really deep interest in history and the characters. Oh, my gosh, the characters there. You really do feel like you're in a film when you're there.
I'm assuming it's made. It's all complete. So where does it go from here?
Well, it was accepted into the Santa Fe Film Festival. So May 1st through 4th, it's going to show at the Santa Fe Film Festival. And I'm hoping to show it to my friends who have helped support me. And there are many people, not just in New Mexico, but across the country, who have been really supportive in every way. I want to be able to show it and, in fact, even have Kathy come up and make pies for people. There are three or four independent film theaters here in Santa Fe, so I kind of have to figure out which one I would like to show it in and see who wants to have me. And I hope to have that happen in April.
You going to try and get it into Traverse City?
Well, of course. And the East Lansing Film Festival, sure.
Okay. Will people have the opportunity to maybe sample this film online? Do you know whether there's going to be any future with that?
I know that I can't have the film online at this point. I'm going to do the film festival circuit for the next year or so, but there is a plan to cut it down a few minutes and tailor it for PBS. And that'll be a little bit down the line, and I'm looking forward to that, of course. And I'm also going to look into the Food Channel and see if they're interested. I have had several different people write to me. I don't want to name names, but, you know, a lot of little leads that I plan on following.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Jane Rosemond, thank you very much for joining us.
No, Melissa, this was so much fun, and it makes me feel close to my Michigan friends, and I hope to see everybody soon, and I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you so much. Happy pie eating.
Oh, hey, thanks. No problem there.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State on WKAR, where our motto is pie for strength. I'm Mark Bayshore. Last fall, a task force was created to help the Lansing School Board figure out what to do with its aging buildings. In January, the group presented their recommendations to the board. However, the fate of many of the district's buildings, including the high schools, remains unknown. The district's modernization plan is supposed to be presented later this month or early in April. Joining us now by phone to discuss the district's efforts is Lansing School Board President Peter Spadafor. Hi, Peter.
Good morning, Mark. How are you today?
I'm well. We're glad you could join us for this.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Last fall, we spoke with Sam Sinacropi and more recently with Kelly Dean, who were key members of the facilities task force. Remind our listeners how many Lansing School District buildings are in need of major repairs.
Well, the simple answer is all of them. We have a really big need for infrastructure improvements across the district, but we're looking at when I got elected, we talked a lot about buildings, and I firmly believe that it's our educators that really do the educating. It's not the bricks and the mortar. But we also have to take into account that our students need a 21st century learning environment like their neighbors. So we've been talking with the superintendent and everyone I've met with, and I know my colleagues on the board are doing the same, where we're starting to talk about the need for a district-wide improvement and modernization plan. And that's where that community task force comes in that you mentioned just a minute ago, where we wanted them to also take a look and see what their recommendations were. And that was presented to the school board, and it was received pretty well. To be clear, it wasn't a final proposal. We took that recommendation, and the superintendent and her team have been poring over that information and then all the rest of the data to try and come up with a more concrete recommendation for a long-term facilities plan. You know, this board has really, I think, taken great strides to try and look at the horizon rather than the immediate right in front of us perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to do the same thing with facilities. In the past, it's been, well, this year we have to save X number of dollars, so we have to close how many buildings to make that reality.
Right.
We're not doing that this time. This time it's about providing, great facilities and looking strategically. I think we're all, we've now acclimated to the fact that this is not a 20,000-30,000 student district. We're a 12,000 student district. How do we right size strategically to ensure that we have space to grow if necessary, but that we're educating the students we have in quality, top-notch, competitive educational environments?
Is the district still losing students, Peter?
It appears that we may have stabilized that student loss. Our fall to winter count this year actually went up by a very small amount, 25 students. But in previous years, we've dropped as many as 200 to 300 in that span.
What do you take that to mean?
Well, I think that it really demonstrates that there's a confidence in the Lansing School District again, that we see parents are making the choice to stay in Lansing or bring their students to Lansing. And I don't have exactly the numbers, how many came in from, that weren't there and are there now and those types of things. But we're up 25 from our fall count. And that's not a lot in the Lansing School District, but that's a whole classroom that we didn't lose. And every time there's a student that comes into this district, he or she, brings with them state funding in the amount of around $7,300. So it's a really good sign to me. It shows, back in 94 or 93 when schools of choice first started to become a reality, the mantra was parents would vote with their feet. We're starting to see parents are voting with their feet and bringing their students back and staying in the Lansing School District. So
I'm so struck between that trend and the fact that the city itself may actually not have to cut anything from its budget. It's almost as if the stars have aligned here between the school districts and between two of the key institutions driving the city of Lansing, the city government itself, and the school district.
Well, and I'm very happy for our counterparts over at City Council and the mayor, of course, because they've done some tremendous work trying to keep that budget, in balance. The school board has never adopted an unbalanced budget. We're adding to our fund balance, and for the first time in a while, we're not looking at dramatic cuts next year. It still might be tough if we do see pupil losses, but the early counts are looking good for us. So I wouldn't count the dollars in the bank quite yet, but I'm remaining optimistic about what it means for our budget next year. The board is looking at all methods of cost saving. One proposal we're talking about right now is leasing the Hill Center out to help us save on $750,000 in utility costs for a building that, for the most part, goes unused.
Mm.
So we're really looking at creative ways to save money too that don't directly affect the classroom.
Let's talk a little bit more here about the high schools in the Lansing School District. How do you see the high schools changing in Lansing in the aftermath of the facilities task force report? How many high schools do you envision in the district?
Well, that's a very good question. We'll always have a need for high schools. We're not going to get rid of that need. But I think how we're doing it can change. And some of the facilities we have are nearly 100 years old and have for years not been a priority in terms of maintenance and upkeep and upgrading. So I think it's unrealistic that the high schools will exist the way we know them in 3 to 5 years. That being said, we want to make sure we give the community time to adjust to any changes that we might be making, and also that we have a place to, move students should a high school close. So this is just a for instance, but one for instance that's been talked about is should Eastern High School be closed, we could take a look at part of a bond proposal to expand Pattengill Middle School into a new Eastern High School campus. I personally am trying really hard not to make the whole facilities conversation about high schools, because I do want to have the entire district benefit from a facilities modernization. So all 12,000 students are receiving a benefit, rather than just, you know, 1,500 in one specific campus. So I want to start by saying that, but I think we're going to have to realistically start looking at what's been circling in Lansing for at least 10 years, and that's the possibility of closing one of the high schools as it exists right now.
What do you make of the task force's recommendation that Eastern become focused on training and insurance and IT, which the task force says are promising job sectors here in the Lansing area? What do you make in particular of that proposal?
Well, I think that is a particularly interesting proposal, and Sparrow, for instance, or Michigan State University or Lansing Community College could be a great partner in that. Now, does that necessarily mean it has to be on that site? You know, Eastern High School could exist somewhere else near there and still be Eastern, you know, still have the Quakers and all of that, and still provide opportunities like a, you know, a biosciences experience, a school within a school, if you will. And I think the school board is very excited about those types of opportunities as well. You take a look at the magnet grants we just launched, 6 new schools, 4 new concepts that are schools within a school type proposals. So this board is really interested in providing unique offerings for our students. We have more offerings than any district in the area, and I don't think that we're interested in ceasing expanding those options.
We're talking with President of the Lansing School Board, Peter Spatafor, about the changes that the board and the district is looking at for the future. What about concern over Eastern's historic nature? Would this factor into the district's decision if they end up selling the building? Would, for example, offers that would preserve the building take a higher priority, do you think?
I think that is one consideration within all of the considerations we have to make. I mentioned also any proposal that comes to the board to, you know, purchase the building, it's going to have to recognize that we here in the district need a place to educate those students until an alternative site can be established. So that's one thing that has to take a look at. If you're looking at somebody who wants to come in and in 6 months turn it around and be seeing a profit on that building, that's a big change for the community right away, and that's not something that I necessarily want to see happen right away. So those are all factors we have to weigh. You know, the historic value of the building is not without merit. You know, it's a beautiful building. It has a great structure, but it's not serving the students as best we can now. So that's why we're having a serious conversation about this. The argument of preservationists is not falling on deaf ears with the school board. We have said if there are folks out there with proposals that are pen to paper ready to be looked at, please bring them to the school board. Mm. We'd love to take a look at them. You know, someone has suggested we put out an RFP. Now, the district is not redeveloping the site, so we're still looking into how an RFP would work when we're not interested in, you know, fronting the money to turn it into office space or condos or those types of things. So that's one of the things our lawyers are going to have to figure out. But the preservationists that are concerned about keeping that facility, or at least part of that facility, they have sympathetic ears on the school board, and I'm one of them. It is one of the factors that we're considering when we look at options for that site.
You just returned from a retreat this past weekend where the board considered some of your options before you. Could you share some of the takeaways from the retreat?
Sure. Well, most of the retreat was spent on, you know, sort of team building and visioning. In fact, we're going to start the long-term strategic planning process in the next couple of weeks, where we'll bring in a lot of the community to start looking at our 3 to 5 year goals that we can then start governing from that document. We have plans in place and goals, but it's time that we start organizing them all so we have a clear direction. And that was the majority of the conversation. The superintendent did share with us a very, very high-level draft version of her recommendations that will be coming to the board more formally. I think the first week of April is when we decided to put that on the agenda. But that was, you know, one of the options was expanding Pattengalen to a 912 facility. We have to, though, put together a bond exploratory committee and start looking at the options for a bond, because we can't do anything right now in large scale, because our operating dollars need to stay operating dollars. They need to go in the classroom.
No movement on the formation of a committee on that yet, then?
Not yet, no. No one has been named or asked yet.
Okay, All right. We've got to leave it there. Great conversation. Peter Spadafor is the president of the Lansing School Board. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Not many college courses offer a movie trailer as an introduction to the class.
How do people act at the beginning of a catastrophe? I'm calling it surviving the coming zombie apocalypse. Does their behavior change in the midst of trying to survive with the decisions that they must make? I'm using the zombie thing to hopefully make the class a little more interesting.
Did you say zombies?
In times of catastrophes, some people find their humanity, others lose theirs.
Zombies? They make everything more interesting.
That was Glenn Stutzke, an MSU professor in the School of Social Work, introducing his class, Surviving the Coming Zombie Apocalypse. Although many classes don't have such dramatic introductions, zombie-themed courses are popping up at college campuses across the U.S. Topics like the economy, religion, and psychology are actually being studied through the lens of the undead. Glenn Stutzke is going into his third summer of teaching Surviving the Coming Zombie Apocalypse here at Michigan State University, and Glenn Stutzke joins us today on Current State. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
How did the idea for this class unfold exactly?
Well, it's an interesting story. The School of Social Work wanted to offer some classes in the summer, some elective classes, and the faculty was given the opportunity to put forward proposals. Well, it has always interested me how people behave during disasters and catastrophes. But I was looking for, the key thing was looking for, well, what kind of disaster did I want to have? A tornado, a tsunami? And in asking my grandson, who was college age, he gave me maybe the best advice I've ever gotten as a teacher. And he said, Gramps, just don't be boring. And I kept that in my mind. And as I was doing my research for emergency response and preparedness, I went to the Center for Disease Control. They're maybe the best in the world at this. And lo and behold, when I clicked on their site, looking right back at me through a Venetian blind was a zombie. My jaw dropped. I couldn't believe zombies and the federal government, they have a sense of humor. And their idea was, we have important information. We want to drive traffic to our site so people will look at it. And I said, that's what it's going to be, zombies.
But I think a lot of people are wondering, what do zombies have to do with social work? Connect those two there for us a little bit more.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the thing is oftentimes, when you are working out in the field in social work, you will come across things that aren't necessarily you learned in a book. Because with humans and with human behavior, that may be one of the most unpredictable things there are. And that there is. And zombies are very much like that. You have to be able to think on your feet. You have to be able to find resources. You have to be able to, in some cases, help people survive.
What do students actually do in the class? How does it work?
Well, there is the academic content, you know, the kind of the traditional academic content where you have the required readings, you have the quizzes, you have those types of things, assignments. But over top of that, we lay a narrative that we use a video. Every week, the students view a video of a small group of survivors, and they're posed different challenges that they themselves have to put looking like they're right in that situation, and what would they do? And they do this from their own small survival group. Every student is put into a small survival group, randomly assigned a location where they are when the catastrophic event happens. They have to find out how to work together to survive, because one thing we try to get across, one of the biggest lessons, Mark, is that the biggest asset that you can take into any kind of disaster or catastrophe is relationships. I was listening to the show earlier here, you know, and from the captain about with Homeland Security and emergency management. You mm-hmm. do need those 72 hours of food and water, but anything that goes beyond that, and even during that time, the most valuable thing you can have is relationships.
Mm. What are students taking away from the course? I mean, this is your third.
This will be the third summer,
I believe you've taught this. Are they taking the lessons away from this that you were hoping they would?
Yes, that's what we're finding out. We do evaluations and assessments. I'll give you one example. At the beginning of the class, we do an assessment asking them if they have ever prepared an emergency plan, if they have an emergency kit for themselves, if they have pets, do they have an emergency kit for their pets? As the captain mentioned earlier, that's very important. And then at the end of the semester, we survey them again. And not surprisingly, because most people, I think, fall into this category, not just students, people have not thought about an actual, you know, emergency plan. They've not prepared an emergency kit. And we're finding that the students, either some of them have now put together a basic emergency plan, and a few even an emergency kit. So we do see a takeaway there.
If 5 years ago somebody had said, Glenn, you're going to put together a class, and the theme of the class is going to be a zombie apocalypse, what would you have thought?
I would have thought impossible. I don't even like zombies. But one thing, Mark, zombies make everything more interesting.
What do you make of this larger trend of zombies becoming a more acceptable vehicle for learning in colleges?
Yeah, that's interesting, because at first there was some, you know, resistance from some quarters in that, and would it be appropriate or not? And as I did my research, I found that already you had places like Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard who were on some even just individual lessons already using this kind of lens to look through. And I would have to say one thing. We have a lot of good content, a lot of good academic content, you know, at universities all over the country and world. But one of the complaints that I hear sometimes from students is that it can be pretty dry and pretty boring. And so I think if we can use in an appropriate and maybe a little bit of in a tongue-in-cheek way to capture students' attention about material that is important, I say, let's do it. And I think that's one reason why some educators have gone that route.
I find it interesting that it's not a zombie apocalypse. It's the zombie apocalypse. There's
yes.
some certainty here that this is actually going to happen.
We need to get ready, Mark.
Ready.gov. Enrollment for the summer session of your class is now open. You've only been at it. This will be the third summer. Has it changed much? Has your approach changed much?
Well, we have gotten it more interactive because this course is fully online. It's an elective. It's at the undergraduate level for MSU students. And as a matter of fact, any other universities, you know, undergraduates can take it as well. And we make it available to community members through lifelong education. We've had people from Canada, even one person from China, who have joined the class. The class has evolved where we're using more technology to help people better to be able to form a sense of community. I would say that's one of the big things that we've done. We want people to have a sense that they are together, even though they may be in many different places around the state or country.
There is a real trendiness to this theme. Oh, I am told we've got to let it go there. I'm sorry to say. But we appreciate your being with us. Glenn Stutzke is a professor in MSU School of Social Work. He teaches the course Surviving the Coming Zombie Apocalypse. Thanks, Glenn. That's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we'll learn more about the other Asian carp, the grass carp, and why it may deserve more attention. Also, we'll discuss local stock exchanges. That and more tomorrow on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for joining us. It's Current State on WKAR.